Good morning. We're going to continue today with the third and last session on the topic we've been doing the past couple of weeks. We're going to start momentarily. And it's on the topic of the passage, I am God, your healer. After God had taken the Jews out of Egypt, he brought them to the bitter waters, and there were a number of lessons that were taught there. For those of you that have the text in front of you, we're doing Exodus 15:27. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi. It's Doug Taylor. How are you?
Good, Doug. How are you?
Excellent. Sean's on the line with us, too.
Hi.
Hi, Sean. Hi, Cal.
Hi.
Good morning.
Okay. So everything was clear about the that part of the Rambam in the Hilchos Melachim?
Yes, although I must admit I'm still surprised that he wrote it the way he did, because it still seems like it has always been historically impractical, or can't be done.
Right, but you can't compromise the what the law is because of the societal impracticalities. I mean, what would you expect?
I hear you.
Yeah, it is pretty severe. It's a hard thing to do, especially the law about having the obligation to judge and then to kill him on the spot.
Yeah, I would think that a court, I mean, a judge would be in a difficult position where you've got one witness who comes in and says that somebody violated one of the seven Noahide laws, and the witness will probably deny it. And I'm kind of wondering how he's going to ferret out, you know, who's telling the truth in a case like that. Whereas if you have multiple witnesses and some of the other, I guess you could call them safeguards or rules that apply to a regular Torah court, it would seem like it would avoid some of those difficulties.
Yeah, it'd be a good question, too, in terms of do they have the same level of investigation and going back and forth. I mean, if you have more than one witness, I'm sure they use it. It's just saying
right.
The minimum is one. But I mean, again, the same injunction on the judge to seek out truth, you know, is going to apply whether it's a Jewish court or a Gentile court.
Yeah, I would certainly hope so. And you know, perhaps then he does a thorough investigation and interviews neighbors and, you know, all kinds of things to find out if there's some other animosity that might be driving the accusation.
Right. And he finds out that there's no real proof, he has to let them go.
Yeah, that could be.
Yep. All right, so we're going to continue today with just there's one more point that I wanted to address on the whole event of God taking the Jews to the bitter waters. And then after that, they seem to just come not too far away to Elim, where they had the 12 pools of water, and the Seventh Day Adventists. So I think there's more here. On the, even though it's just one verse, this is a 15:27 is where we are. So we, up to this point, we realize that the Jews had been. We suggested one point is that the main point that we addressed is that the Jews needed to replace their sense of authority with God. At this point, they had the authority figure, which was the Egyptians, and we see how they wanted to embody that freedom by taking the bread and to, you know, create it into something which was a symbol of being freed. That's what they saw their Egyptian oppressors eating the entire 210 years they were in bondage. The God had retarded the loaf from rising, and he rushed them out. And we see that this is a very significant part of Passover. A very significant element in the formation of the Jews was to not to allow that bread to rise. So we asked, what's so significant about whether the bread rises or not? So I think our answer explains that and shows how it is so central, that they weren't being freed for the sake of freedom, but they were being freed from bondage of one type to become servants to God. That they would be able to have the life that God had created mankind for to begin with. So that was essential. That they now when they lost this sense of the authority figure when the Egyptians were killed on the seashore. So now that the danger exists, that now they're going to express just complete unbridled freedom. So God took them to the bitter waters, and the lesson there was that if you follow my ways and you keep the Torah, because they were taught the commands over there, so then you will, even all the diseases of Egypt will not be placed upon you. And we also saw a beautiful insight that the laws, according to what the Talmud says, that they were taught, the three laws there about honoring parents and establishing courts and Sabbath. So that all targeted the three, I guess, authority roles that a person has in their life: the parents, and then societal judges, which is courts, and God, of course, which is keeping the Sabbath. So therefore, we understand that the purpose of receiving these laws at this time was specifically addressing the nature of the people. So in terms of the formation of the Jewish people, it was essential that, number one, that they don't have this view of God as being negative. Those were the 10 plagues, they were all negative, and even the killing of the Egyptians on the seashore, they then had to now have they had to be neutralized. It was too weighted in terms of seeing the negative aspects of what God does, so God therefore made the water sweet. He did a positive act. At the same time, you know, it was necessary that the authority that they had was now removed, that they didn't have this fear of the Egyptians anymore, or this desire to have that freedom like the Egyptians, but now that they should have the right authority. So they're taught the three laws over here in terms of honoring parents and establishing courts and the Sabbath, because these target that very idea. So it really worked out beautifully in terms of what the step-by-step development was in terms of what God's plan is. Right? I think that was pretty much what we covered up to this point. Right, Doug? All right. How's the sound, by the way?
Pretty good.
Okay, good. Let me just bring the phone as close as I can over here. I can bring it closer. And now what we want to do is just try to understand the last part in this development. Okay, so the last part of this development is where they, after they have the bitter waters, and now, and God makes them sweet, and he tells them that it's contingent upon you following the laws. So now they come to a place which has 12 pools of water, sweet, drinkable, delicious water, and 70 date trees. Now, to say that these things were created at this moment, well, the Jews didn't see that happen. They didn't see these trees just to pop out of the ground, and then to see to see a desert, then all of a sudden irrigated with 12 dry pools of water. So these, as far as they're concerned, have been there. And actually one of the rabbis quotes this and says that they were there from creation. Right. It's in what's called the Mechilta, and it's a statement of Rabbi Eliezer, and this is brought down in the Ramban, Nachman it is. So it's by Rabbi Eliezer Hamodoi, and he says that from the day that God created his world, he created the 12 pools corresponding to the 12 tribes, and the 70 date trees corresponding to the 70s of Canaan, the 70 elders. So this was at the outset of the world that this was created, because God knew that this event would take place. Evidently, there's a very important lesson over here. If God had created this at the beginning of creation. So we see that they correspond to some element of the Jewish people. All right. The question is, what's the lesson? That's the question. And how is this appropriate at this time to have this lesson? It seems to be it's in conjunction with Mara, with the whole event of Mara, because it's both about their needs. At Mara, they didn't have the needs, and God made a miracle. Then they come to the place of Elim, and there is no miracle done, but they just find these trees and pools of water that correspond to numbers of the Jews. Okay. And who are these Jews? Why the 12 and the 70? Why not just one? Why not just 12? Or why not just 7? They had the water already, so just make 70 date trees. So it's interesting what that's for. Now, it's not, I don't think it's so apparent on the surface, but there's a very profound lesson here. And the first thing I just want to, again, the purpose of the class is really that you think about the issues. But I would just frame the first, question here is that, what is the difference between what happened at the Bitter Waters and what happened when they came to Elim, where they had the 70 date trees and the 12 pools of water? What was different what was the essential difference between those two events? Yes.
Seems like right off the bat, the difference that you noticed was that when they came to the Bitter Waters, the water was like that, and it was miraculously changed by putting a branch or the stick into it. And these two things were created at the beginning of creation. They were like that.
So how would you categorize the difference?
Because one was changed when they arrived, and the other existed before they were arrived there.
Okay, to say that one was changed, you use the word miracle, right?
Right.
But that applies to when the water was bitter and then it turned sweet. Now, in terms of the 70 date palms and the 12 pools, was that a miracle in your estimation or not?
Well, it seems like a pretty significant coincidence.
Yes. But it's part of how God created the world. Right? That was Rabbi Eliezer Hamodoi who made that statement. So he says that it wasn't a miracle on the spot. It was something how God formed the world. He made sure that was part of the design. So that's not called miracle. What is that called?
God's design or God's plan.
All right.
But it also seems like it was created for a purpose, like God's plan was already set in place before the sequence of time events, and that there isn't time in God's realm.
Correct. I think what you're saying is basically one was miracle and one was not. I mean, when God created the world, we don't say, I mean, again, that is a miracle, too, the fact that But miracle is usually termed when you already have a set system of laws, and then you have a deviation in those laws. Whereas when God was creating the world, there was no set system of laws yet. There was no such thing as natural law yet until everything was completed on the seventh day. Would that be accurate?
Right.
Right. So if we had to define what miracle is a suspension of laws, and that would not be applicable when we're talking about how God created the world from the outset. Okay. So then we see now we see an opening in terms of what the two events were over here. There's a miraculous event, and then there's also seems to be where they just come to this place, they alight at this new place, Elam, and everything is set up. You know, seems to be perfectly in line with the nature of these people. Now we said that one lesson was that they had to recognize that God was not punitive, but that now God was doing a good act. So he was making the water sweet. So this was now different in contrast to the 10 plagues and the destruction of the Egyptians on the seashore, in the Red Sea. So now he's doing a positive act, and that's why it ends up by saying that I am God, your healer, because one primary lesson was to let them have to neutralize the view that they had that God is not only punitive, but He can do positive things as well. I think there was one very big lesson. I think another very big lesson here between these two stories is there's a difference between what happened with the water becoming sweet and the difference between what was happening in terms of the 12 pools and the 70 dates, 70 date palms. And also, I think the numbers will hint to us why there's a difference. Meaning, when we contrast what God did in terms of miracles, who did he do that for? And in terms of what the number of 70 and 12 represent, right? So let's try to understand that for a minute. Maybe that will give us some sort of a direction. Who are the 12 and who are the 70?
Rabbi, can I interject one thought?
Sure.
That we talked about before, and that is that they come to the bitter waters, and first of all, they get the opportunity to experience a miracle of Hashem changing it, which is a positive. Then he brings them into another situation that is positive right off the bat, and it certainly can't have gone unnoticed by them that there were 12 pools and 70 date palms, and that they would make the connection between the 12 tribes of Israel and the 70 elders. So is it that God is saying, not only can I change a negative situation to a positive one, but I can bring you continually into situations that are sort of have my personal signature on them and they're custom made for you?
Right. I would go further with it, though. You're right. Exactly. He definitely wants them to recognize this, and surely God doesn't do any futile actions. So this lesson, of course, he knew they would see. And so you're saying the lesson is that God will continually bring them to good places. But the nature of the event was not miraculous, is what I'm trying to, I'm trying to show there's a contrast here between the two events. So God is aligning in his Torah two events, so there has to be some sort of a contrast. There's some relationship why this is here, right after the bitter water miracle. And now they come to a place where naturally things are designed around the exact structure of certain key elements in the Jewish people. Right? That we both agree on. So what do these 12 and these 70 represent is the question now.
Well, the 12 would represent the 12 tribes of Israel, and the 70 would represent the number of elders that went down into Egypt in the first place.
Right. Well, there wasn't 70 elders that went down. There were 70 people. And the 70 also, there's also a number of elders that were 70. So there were two 70s.
Wow.
And it could be that there's a connection as well. But for now, we'll stick with what the rabbis say and say there's 12 tribes. Those were the 12 pools of water. And the 70 date palms correspond to these 70 elders. Now, what is significant about those two units, 12 tribes and the 70 elders. Again, that's what God has designed this location of Elim around. So now we have to understand the significance, right? That would be the next question, correct?
Right.
Okay, so this is what we want to try to understand. And keep in mind also that the 12 and the 70 were not a miraculous event, whereas the Jews that came out of Egypt and now had the need for water, God did make a miraculous event. Right, so we now notice that there is the miracle was done for one group, but then when they got to the Elim, that was designed around a certain the ancestors, so to speak, or a certain element, the 12 tribes, right, who already had passed away, and now all their descendants are there. There are 2.5 million descendants are there, and the 70 elders. So what is the significance between those two? That's our question. Not even know who they are, who the trees and the pools of water represent. What is the significance of them? We have to go step by step, and we'll slowly uncover what the lesson is here.
Well, the 70 elders are leaders.
Right.
The 12 tribes are the breakdown of the group, but also point to, a type of structure and leadership, because there would be a leader of each tribe.
Okay.
It almost seems like he's recognizing substantiating is the right word, the structural organization of Israel.
Structural organization.
Can I add to that?
Please, go ahead.
He set up the structure as a necessity, just as water and shade are the necessity in a desert. Like it's the lifeblood or the main staple of what you need to have.
But what is the significance of the 12 and the 70? We know who they are now. Now what's the significance of them? And again, we're trying to, and the second question will be after we understand the significance, is why are they correlated to an event that was not miraculous? Right? Those trees and pools were there from day one.
Could it be that the 12 tribes, the significance of them was recognizing how they came to be? The whole patriarch system is representative of the Jewish nation, and to reflect back on that representation of the Jewish nation.
Okay.
I'm going to guess that it's significant, too, that in the Bitter Waters incident, the 12 and the 70 don't show up at all.
Right. Why not?
Obviously, that incident didn't have to do with that, but was trying to teach something else.
Yeah, and that was tied with the condition that if you listen to my commands and you guard them, then all the disease in Egypt won't put on you.
Right.
Right? So he's giving a lesson over there. That's in terms of Torah. But I think that brings out the contrast even more. See, what's going on is that the 12 tribes are basically, you were getting on to, Cal. This was pre-Torah. The significance of the 12, in my mind, and I had thought the 70 could also be the 70 descendants, meaning those descendants of the 12 and the 12 themselves are both units of people that were pre-Torah, before God took the nation and made them into a nation, and now established a whole new people. So So what is God saying? It seems to be that there may be two, you know, one categorical lesson, but there's two essential parts, and that's like this. That in terms of God's providence, we know that there are two elements of the providence. There is this general providence, which, like Maimonides says, that God makes sure that that nature works, that there's what they call hashgacha kolios, that there's general providence, that the world is sustained every day. And then there's specific providence, which is where God intervenes and suspends certain laws. You had this throughout time. This is not new, meaning to say that both are how God always works, that God doesn't change. So these were two ideas that were clear. We see that Abraham was thrown into a fire and he was saved miraculously. And we see that when Eliezer goes to get a wife for Yitzchak, the first woman he sees, that's it, right away. God has worked out the situation. I don't necessarily that that's a miracle. Clearly, Abraham being saved is a miracle. And there definitely were, God spoke to them. That's clearly direct providence, you know, individual providence. And there was also general providence. I mean, when Rivka had the two inside of her, so she didn't know what was going on. There was such a tumult inside her stomach that it was unnatural pregnancy, and she went to inquire from the yeshiva of Shem and Aver, and she went to inquire of prophecy as to what is going on, and they informed her. And you see that the angels came to Abraham also, and God spoke with him, and he saved Lot. So you see that there are many cases of individual providence, meaning a specific providence over an individual, and we also see this general providence. So that always existed, even before Torah. But now God is taking the people out, and now he's establishing a nation. So it could very well be that what was necessary is that the two lessons were now given again and shown on a national level. Meaning this is true, this is how God worked before the Torah. But keep in mind that the way that they didn't have a Torah yet, so they were living their life based on just their intelligence. Of course they knew about the seven Noahide laws, but primarily their lives were guided by using their reason, and we explained last week that Adam had only one law, according to Rabbi Yehuda, and Noah then had seven, and then the Jews got 613. So as time progressed, more laws were necessary. But if you go back in time, less were given, indicating perhaps that the plan that God had was that he just put Adam and Eve on the earth with intelligence, with the ability to live their lives. They had everything they needed. They could live autonomously now. It wasn't until later corruptions perhaps demanded that more laws came into the picture. Or maybe God's plan was he was going to eventually give the Torah at a certain point. I mean, the Talmud does say that. But the fact that he didn't give it up to that point shows that man was not going to lose anything and had the ability to live that way. But then God makes the nation. And the two lessons he gives as soon as he takes them out is that he'll involve himself specifically and make the water sweet. That's a miracle. Right? That's contingent upon the people now following his system. Now that he has a new nation, now that for the first time, God is now going to apply this providential a relationship to a nation, but that's contingent upon following laws. That wasn't in existence before, that there was a providence over a nation. So each individual enjoyed it as terms in terms of their own personal development. But now that God created a nation, he now took those two laws of those two areas of providence and taught them to the people right now. If you follow the system of the laws and you accept the authoritative roles, the parents and the judges and Shabbos, meaning God, now any disease that comes upon you won't have. All the diseases of Egypt will not afflict you, because I am God, your healer. That was the one law, in terms of that he steps in and he will function with them on a individual basis as the nation. The other lesson was when they then came from Marah and they went to Elam, and now they found these 12 pools of water and 70 date trees, but this was designed there from the beginning. So what was the lesson there? The lesson there is just like the 12 tribes and the 70 Jews who descended, or 70 elders. this was pre-Torah, and in a pre-Torah lifestyle, you see that the world, the lesson is that the world is designed to service those people who live the right life, not on a miraculous basis, but on general God's general laws of providence. The reason why he established the world a certain way, it finds its real objective in those people who use their intelligence and live properly. So the lesson also they had to know is not only is there is going to be individual providence in terms of suspending laws of nature, and God can do that, but they also had to understand that the whole way the world is designed in a natural framework is specifically for the individuals that follow God just based on how they understand the world, just by observing and seeing the wisdom that unfolds from the world. And who embodies that type of lifestyle? The people before the Torah, the 12 and the 70. So, and we discussed this once before, a few months ago, we saw some verses, I don't forget where it is now, but there was two verses where God wanted to show how that even today, even the way we live our lives today with the Torah, we still should not forget how the life of the Jews pre-Torah, the life of individuals that weren't Jews yet, the life of just human beings pre-Torah, those who lived properly and just followed intelligence, they had, I mean, to say that the lesson that we see here, that the 12 pools of water and the 70 date palms correspond to the individuals who didn't have a Torah yet, to teach that lesson that the world is basically designed. That's what the 12 and the 70 represent here. That God's world is designed, even without miracles, is designed to service those people who live properly. And the 12 tribes, they live properly. And the 70s of Canaan, with the 70 descendants of the 12 tribes that came down to Egypt, also lived properly. So there was two lessons here. Two lessons were necessary for the people to know in terms of how their relationship to God is. There's individual providence, there's suspension of miraculous, there's suspension of laws, which are miracles. So that was Mara, where he was able to step in and take care of that. But they can't be, they have to also see what existed prior, and what will continue to exist. And that is that they should understand that the nature of how the world was set up from the outset, for the original individuals that lived according to wisdom. So this is where the good life is really going to be catered to, that God will ensure that those people who live the proper life will have all the good. And that's a very important lesson, because it's not just to have God stepping in and doing miracles, but to understand and appreciate that the whole natural setup of the world is really not just there unrelated to Torah. It's a synthesis. The world is set up with the objective of man having knowledge of God and coming closer to God. And that's exactly what these 12 pools and the 70 date palms now taught the Jews. They recalled now who these people were, who these numbers are, and it was before having a system of Torah, and nonetheless, the world was catering to them. So it was a lesson over here, the dual lesson of how the providence engages man on two different levels. Okay, let me pause for a second, see if there's any comments or questions.
So it's presumed that the people know that the 12 and the 70 kind of represent those people who are following God's way.
Yes.
So they'll get that idea.
Exactly. That, and they contrast that with the Egyptians who are completely destroyed, who are idolatrous. But they have to be taught both lessons. They can't have an idea that it's just miracles, 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 and that's not the only way God relates. The whole world, you now have to have the bigger picture now. It's true, God will step in. But the person has to understand, and this they studied. Rabbi Chaim gave a beautiful class on that, how they, Be'er L'chai Ro'i. So, that was the well. So, The class he gave was showing how they had studied, that the patriarchs and the matriarchs were involved in studying God's providence. And this is how they wanted to understand it. Things that were hidden from them, they couldn't arrive at on their own, so God would tell them directly. That's what God said to Abraham. I think we mentioned in the last week as well. He says, "Will I keep hidden from Abraham what I will do to Sodom?" And Abraham is going to a great nation, and he will instruct his household afterwards to follow the ways of God. So since Abraham was living that type of lifestyle, and God wants that man should have greater knowledge of God, that is our entire reason for existence. So whatever a man can't arrive at on his own, that's the concept of prophecy. But God will now initiate communication, and he will give further information. So he engaged Abraham in a discussion, and know that Abraham can now acquire more and learn even more about God's providence. So we see that that's the lesson. As soon as they leave, now they have to understand the relationship between God and the people. But now that he was setting up the nation, there's a new concept of him doing, of him involving himself directly with the nation. So that was, you know, another layer in terms of what they were taught at Marah. Just seeing the miracles there shows that God is going to be involved, and the fact that he took them out of Egypt. But Egypt and the Red Sea, those were all punitive measures. So now they have to have that neutralized and see that God also does positive. They have to have a clear, equal, it has to be an equal balance in terms of their view of God. It has to be an accurate view. But at the same time, all that is happening, now they go to a place where there's no miracle happening, but it's designed around the central numbers that embody the Jewish nation, or the not the Jewish nation, but the predecessors of the Jewish nation, who were individuals who recognized God without a system of Torah, and just by living in line with their reason, they were able to arrive at what the truth is. And we see that God catered to them by creating the world in a way where everything is there to service these people. So it's a dual lesson. We have to, it's understanding both areas of how God relates. And each should be, you know, just as appreciated, because they both target the same goal. And that is to ensure that those who live a life of wisdom, those God favors. And it straddles both. Before there are any Jews, and it's just individuals, and afterwards, for God's objective, he had to take a people, that the only monotheistic people at the time, and just to ensure the salvation for the rest of the world. So really, the creation of the Jew, so some Jews will take it as arrogance. Really, God is creating the Jew for the sake of the rest of the world. So it's really that the Jew is in service. I mean, the Jew is also important because he's equally a human being as anybody else. But it's for the sake of at least having some pocket of people that had the right ideas, holding on to them, learning more of them, and then going out to the world and to make them known. Until eventually, we'll have the days of the Messiah, when he will be greater in wisdom than King Solomon, and close to the prophecy of Moses. And with his wisdom, he'll be able to, you know, enlighten people. And I'm not sure what else will happen, what miracles will happen, but you know, the truth of God will be known very readily in those days. And that will be for everybody. So it's, right now it's just a temporal interim state, that there's just one nation that has a system, but eventually it's to bring about the situation where everybody has it. That's what we'd mentioned a couple of weeks ago, that it's, if the like we're reading Isaiah in the beginning, and it says that all the nations will stream to Jerusalem to learn God's Torah. But they will only do that. It's not going to be a miracle that one morning all the nations wake up and they've been living corruptly their whole life, and then that's the, and they've been doing this for years and decades and millennium, and then they wake up one morning and everybody's now going to want to learn Torah. It doesn't happen like that. It must be that there are certain prerequisites that are going to foreshadow that the time of the Messiah, that the ideas will be made available, that they will see truth, that the Jews will also will teach, they'll make the ideas available to the rest of the world. So that seems to be a precursor. Otherwise, how are the nations going to say, hey, this is a system that I want to now travel to Israel and study. And they must be around for a while, and they must have been exposed to real truths. But you see over here as well that the, both types of human condition are being straddled. The human condition pre-Torah and also with Torah. So that the lesson of when you have the Torah and you follow properly, God will step in. Yes, there's a special providence he will have for that nation, because this is now the plan for the whole world. So he will step in and shield that people in order that they can deliver the ideas to the rest of the world. But the world itself, from the outset, even before Torah, was designed in a way, just naturally, that it caters to people that are living properly. And God set up the world for that reason. There's the, you know, the story about Jacob, when he had left because his brother's going to kill him. And he came to what was we know today as Mount Moriah. And he slept there that night, and he... So it says that he took from the stones of that place and sort of like made like a cape around his head, or some sort of an elevated thing, like a pillow, whatever it was. And in the morning he woke up, and it says that after the miracle of the angels and the ladder, he said, wow, how awesome this place is. And he took the stone that was under his head, and he anointed it as a monument to show significance to the fact that he had this prophecy. So the comments of Rashi says that, what do you mean he took the stone? It said previously he took from the stones of the place the day before. And now it says he took the stone. So the medrash, you know, the metaphor that the rabbis write, they say, yes, what happened was that all of the rocks were now, they had a quarrel, one with the other. And each rock said, let the righteous man put his head on me. The other rock said, no, let the righteous man put his head on me. And God made a miracle, and he turned all the rocks into one. So this is a metaphor. But what does it mean? What does it mean that the rocks were all arguing? I mean, inanimate objects are inanimate. But it means to say that rock, which is purely a physical substance, and that's it. So it represents just the physical world. And the fact that it's arguing one with the other implies that the physical world is, so to speak, desirous of being used properly only by the righteous. So that what it teaches you is that really the righteous people are the ones who really benefit the most. That's what the physical world is here for. The physical world is here primarily as an assistance for individuals that desire to learn about God, that they do so. And that's what this metaphor is teaching. So we see that that's the same idea here about the 12 pools of water and the 70 date trees, that the physical world is designed around those righteous individuals, individuals that using their intelligence could arrive at the truth and live their lives based on pursuing knowledge of God. It's clear, right? Makes sense.
Yes, it does.
Right. So it's interesting, just a few passages and a tremendous amount of wisdom is being imparted. But that has to be the case. I mean, this is God's, these are God's words. So there has to be a tremendous amount of knowledge to be derived. So you see at the formation of the people, they have to understand now this relationship that they had with God. And it's on two levels. Individual, now that they formed as a new people, but also, not only does God do miracles, and that's for the people that were now taken out, but that there is a general providence, that God's setup of the world is designed specifically to benefit and be used for the best by the righteous. So that means that the righteous individual, a person is living properly, and his life is in the context of a Torah lifestyle. So that individual is going to have the most enjoyable life and will make use of the world in the best way, and foods and scenery and every aspect of life and friendships are going to find their purest and truest form, and the most happiest enjoyments are going to be experienced by people that live by God's system, because He designed the physical and He designed the Torah, and if we and they have to work in sync. One is in the service of the other. That's what we see about these 70 date trees and the 12 pools. But they are designed that the physical world is here and will service those individuals, those people. And if we live that type of lifestyle, we will have that as well. We will really see how everything that we experience in the world is really fits in and services the lifestyle of pursuing God. At every turn, we'll see that. We won't abuse things. We won't be running after more and more wealth. We'll see what the real purpose of monetary sustenance is for, that we'll use properly. And like Pirkei Avos says, that who is a rich person? A person who's satisfied with his wealth. So a person has what his needs are. Then he's using... he's not trying to get anything else more out of his monetary. As long as he takes care of his mortgage, his rent, his food, his clothing, his family, if he goes after his physical needs in that sense, he's not going to need that much relative to others. He'll give him more time. He'll have more peace of mind. He'll have less possessions. So again, he'll be somebody who has less anguish, because that too, Pirkei Avos says, that if you increase your possessions, you increase your anxiety. And you see that people have so much invested in the stock market, they're constantly preoccupied with it. Or if there's so many objects and so many new autos, so they're worried about the scratch on this one, and they're worried about that, and how do I keep up with this person's buying next door to me? So the life becomes a complete turmoil of emotions that do not do anything for happiness, and just the opposite, make them completely miserable. I was reading recently how somebody who won some lottery, in the span of that year, his daughter committed suicide. She'd overdosed or something on the drugs because she got all the money, and his brother-in-law, or now maybe an uncle, somebody else, is now at odds with him, and he lost all the money, and he spent it on this, and it did not do anything but ruin his life. And he said himself, he wished that he had thrown out the ticket. And unfortunately, that's, I'm sure, many times that happens. And but if the physical is looked at in terms of what is the purpose of this, of having wealth, it's to allow you to have a situation where you have a roof over your head and proper clothing, and all your needs are taken care of, as a prerequisite to allowing you time to be involved in the higher realm of things. That's wisdom. I mean, the scientists have it wrong in one respect. You know, the scientists, the astronomers, the astrophysicists, so they look at the world, they look at the universe, and they are marveling at creation. Now, of course, that is, you know, we're supposed to. Rambam says it, Maimonides says, if you want to have love of God, you study creation. However, they look at creation as an end in itself. And that's not what God did. God created the physical world to function pretty much as a laboratory for man to come closer to God in terms of knowledge. That's why it says that although the Sabbath was the last day in creation, it was the first in God's thought. We say this every Friday night. Sof b'maseh b'machshava t'chila. Sabbath was the last thing in creation, but it was the first thing in God's thought. What does that mean? It means that Sabbath is where we're completely removed from any type of work in order that our minds are purely engaged without the worrying about procuring this and going to the office. And this, we have one day a week where we are supposed to be involved in study. And the world is really what we look at to study. So, of course, we have to procure all of our needs. So we do that 6 days. But really, all of that work is for the objective of giving us the ability to have time to be removed from going after those needs, and in putting that time into understanding God and understanding what we can about his nature and about his creations. So we see again that even Sabbath itself is something which, and maybe that's why I was here at Mara as well, because it again, the objective of when the Jews came out was to relinquish that feeling of authority, that view of authority on the Egyptians, and now accept God as really being the authority. And that's really what their life is to be about. And that's what the 12 tribes in the 70s of Canaan. There's the Canaan with the wise men, and the 12 tribes were wise in terms of living a lifestyle. That's why those two numbers, because they represented individuals that were living a life of wisdom. So we see the Sabbath itself points to this very concept that they were taught here at Elim. Okay, let me pause at this point. That's pretty much what I feel that wraps up the area we've been doing for the past couple of weeks. But I wasn't satisfied until we actually tried to, you know, attempt to understand what are these 12 pools and these 70 trees. Clearly, there's a lesson. So hopefully we've, you know, derived some of that lesson.
Rabbi?
Yes, Cal?
I was also wondering if there's a correlation between, if you look at how God carefully and strategically laid out the plan from the beginning of creation to where we are now. If we look at that as a model of how the intelligent, and if we use that as a model for ourselves of carefully laying out or looking at our lives or whatever it is that we're doing using our intelligence, that the rewards will be there for us also.
Yeah, clearly that's a lesson. That's exactly what the lesson is here by Elim. If we live like those original intelligent people, the 12 tribes, right? The Bnei Noach, they were the forerunners of the Jews. So if we live this lifestyle, clearly that's the lesson, that we will have the world, we will enjoy, and we'll see how the world is. God set it up already. God knows all future generations. He knows every individual that's coming on earth. This is not news to him. So when we live properly, the world will be something that we find is going to take care of our needs. Just like them. So they, like you're saying, that is a lesson for all time. It's a lesson for all generations.
Does that imply then that if one wants to have more time to be involved in the world of study and learning, but is, you know, involved in making a living and can't seem to break out of that, that there is something lacking in that life that the person needs to look at?
Yes. I mean, Pirkei Avos addresses that specifically. And it says the person should minimize his work and maximize his learning. At the same time, if you don't have work, if you have no flour, they say, then you have no Torah. I mean, if you have no bread to eat, you can't learn. So you have to make sure you're taking care of your needs. But you should do it in a sensible manner where it's not, you're putting in too much time into the work that's not necessary. You have to take a real, you know, calculation and evaluate what the needs are. And, you know, work that way. And unfortunately, a lot of people are working, for an employer. So there are, you know, demands in terms of the structure of the hours. The person can, however, you know, make adjustments. He definitely should. And he'll see that the more he's involved, he can't just sit back and study without any work. That's called relying on a miracle, which the Torah speaks against. You have to use intelligence and try to approach, you know, your work life in a way where it's servicing your life of Torah study. So a person definitely is lacking if he's putting too much time into work, and he really has the ability to minimize that, because then he'll gain more by being involved and study more. He'll be satisfying himself, he'll be happier, and he'll also be that much more, the more knowledge he has, so the more he'll be underneath, you know, God's providence. So that definitely should be our objective, is to try to really maximize our hours of study.
Thank you.
Sure. All right, any other questions, comments?
None here.
None there. All right, so maybe we'll wrap it up here. Unless anything comes up, we'll pick up with Isaiah again next week. We had to finish off, I think, chapter 3. Maybe one other thing that I may want to look at. So I'll touch base with you during the week just to give you a heads up as to what specifically we'll do. Sounds good?
Good.
All right, so I'll be in touch with you during the week. You guys have a great week. Any other questions, Doug, Cal, Brian, everybody, Mary, whoever has, you know, feel free to send them in and try to address them timely.
Okay. Thanks so much, Rabbi.
Sure, great. Have a great day. Enjoy.
Thank you.
Okay. Be well.